The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. In October last year, England's 6-0 victory in Bulgaria was overshadowed by monkey chants and Nazi salutes. The game was stopped twice before half-time. The following day, we did a Football Weekly special where we asked if that was a watershed moment. 2 weeks later, Bulgaria were asked to play their next game behind closed doors and fined €75,000. Today, we ask that question again. We always planned to do a follow-up to that podcast, not because racism was in the news, but because we felt it was important. But since the death of George Floyd and the protests and marches in the US and the UK around the world, it felt important to talk about football's reaction to it right now. A lot of people are asking themselves searching questions at the moment, and that's what we want to do on today's Guardian Football Weekly. Our panel today is the writer Elliot Ross, head of development at Kick It Out, Troy Townsend, and from Channel 4 News and the host of YouTube Cultural Debate Show, it's All Black academic Jordan Jarrett Bryan. And normally on a podcast, you say, hi, how are you? Everyone says, I'm fine, thanks. And then you move on. But I'll start with you, Troy, and I ask, how are you? And I really want you to tell me how you are.
Probably the hardest how are you question to answer that I've ever had, to be totally honest, Max. I'm drained. I'm tired. The situation that is happening at the moment that has highlighted so many different conversations that has also brought the ignorance of many to fore is a tough thing to battle, to persistently have to call out. There is so much going on in the world, and I appreciate everything that's going on in the world. And we do have a pandemic that, you know, is causing distress, loss of life. We have a disease that has never actually gone away. So this period of time, although I should be celebrating a little bit, because, you know what, as I look to my left and look to my right, I now see more allies. I see more supporters. I see people actually appreciating and understanding probably some of the messages that I've been sending for far too long. There's not a part of me that doesn't feel that it's draining. There's not a part of me that doesn't feel that sometimes, what am I waking up for and what am I waking up to? So it's a long response, but it's probably the most difficult how are you I've ever had.
Jordan?
Yeah, similar. We're tired. We're exhausted. As the black community, I'm tired, and we are in pain. We're hurting. It's a little bit. It's not a new wound. It's like a reopened wound. It's a wound that's been there for all of my lifetime and prior to me being on this earth. And I think many black people can relate universally at the moment in regards to what it feels like to have lost another member of our community and of humanity with impunity. It's been refreshing going to some of the marches. I've been to 3 of the 4 marches in London and seeing the numbers grow, you know, by another 5,000 each march is refreshing to see. But we're tired, and I think that that's coming out now in lots of public figures. We've seen certain actors and comedians and high-profile figures, broadcasters publicly and breaking down in tears, be it on their Instagram feeds or on their radio shows or wherever. Ashley Waters, John Boyega, Claire Amfo, Sideman, just to name 4. And that pain and those tears are very authentic tears that we can all relate to. I've spoken to members of my family that have all said it's been a tough 10 days, and we're all the tears are there and the pain is there. So we're tired, but we won't quit. We'll continue to fight because we have to.
Yeah, I think it's worth sort of noting along the lines of what Troy and Jordan have just been saying and what they've been describing, just how difficult their position is. As people who are asked to come onto like a forum like this to talk about these kinds of issues, and to do so recurrently, it's a really, really difficult position to be in. I guess I've been heartened by the protests and by the sense of like real resistance. I thought it was incredible that on the same day that the statue of Colston in Bristol was thrown into the into the sea that same day the Minneapolis Police Department, it was announced it was going to be disbanded. It's an accomplishment I don't think many people could have imagined. I think a lot of people would have said that kind of thing, particularly in the context of the governments that we've seen and the political success of the far right. I think it's an astonishing accomplishment. And I think what we're seeing is that the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been derided as divisive, is actually something that brings people together, and that there's now, we're beginning to glimpse something like a coalition.
I think you made a really interesting point, Elliot, and I'd throw that straight to Jordan and say, how does it feel to continually be asked to talk about this? Because we agonized last week about whether to do this podcast, because we wanted to do it, and we've always wanted to do it since we did that special 8 months ago, and we didn't want to be driven by the news agenda. We just wanted to do it because we felt it was important. But sometimes the news, like I said in the intro, it takes over. But at the same time, it must be difficult to continually be asked to talk about this stuff.
It is. While it's very frustrating and again tiring to constantly have to do interviews, you know, and Troy's got it 10 times more than me about this subject, because it's not only for someone like Troy, his job, he's actually a Black man first and foremost. So there's the emotional, personal pain that he has to go through, never mind the professional element with Kick It Out on his head as well. For me, yes, it is annoying. I listen to the podcast every single week, and I've heard all the shows that you guys have done when dealing with this subject, and there've always been shows that have felt authentic and accurate. And we need to keep doing those shows. I guess the flip of the coin is that if you don't have Black people on these sorts of shows and platforms, many of whom I know refuse to now do these sorts of things because they're only called up to talk about racism, is then, well, we're not in the room then. And you have a bunch of, what's my bigger frustration, a bunch of four white guys talking about racism in football or racism in society, which I think is the worst of the two evils. So while it is tiring having to kind of only be called up for these sorts of discussions, I'd rather that than none of us be on those panels as well. I think it's important that we have our authentic voices heard about what we're feeling in regards to this subject. I think it says a lot about a lot of platforms that only do jump on this bandwagon when it is, you know, trending and newsworthy. And that says a lot as well. But I like to think that you guys do this because you know that it's important to do alongside the football chat as well. The problem, just to kind of conclude that point, that I think a lot of platforms like here, your podcast, is that you don't have any Black people on your production team. And as far as I'm aware, you don't have any Black people on your regular panels. So rather than having to call up myself or Troy when this sort of thing happens, if you had somebody Black on your panel who just knew about football, even on one every 3 weeks, then it would seem even more authentic because that person is on your podcast anyway. So I think that's something that the likes of The Guardian, other platforms, I work at TalkSport, as do you, at Channel 4, where I also work, and other broadcasters as well, need to look at. How do we get more Black journalists, broadcasters, voices integrated into our programs anyways? When these subjects come up, we're not scrambling for the Black voice.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things that resonated from what Jordan said there. One of them is the go-to people that always seem to be when there is this topic, you know, and this is why I appreciate this platform. And I'm not bigging you guys up just because I'm on it, but because, you know, after England ball to Gary and the very quick phone calls to put the program together, it wasn't done as tokenism. It wasn't done as, well, we need to do something, who can we get? There was a power to it, there was a structure to it, there was an understanding to it, and there were very, very powerful voices on there. And it goes out, it was on a podcast, and I don't know how long we spoke for, but it was definitely an hour. What I'm tired of is doing the news outlets that say, Troy, can we get you on? We need you with this. And then provide 6 seconds of what you say in a package, and the relevance of what you say is totally lost on an audience that actually is always critical anyway, because you're talking about racism. So I'm not giving up my time anymore, me personally, to the news outlets that want the sound bites. to the news outlets that want you to add to their package to make it look good because you're the one and only. So I would rather give my voice and channel the energy where my voice can be heard properly, where people can appreciate and hear the emotion in my voice, and people can understand. And Jordan's spot on there. I have to come from two angles. But first and foremost, I'm a black man that's hurting as well. And I'd rather have that platform than the platforms that people think are, you know, because it's going out on ITN News or BBC News, it's the most important platform to have.
I want to come back in part three to what Jordan said about certainly some important questions for the podcast and for diversity in the media. What have you made of football's reaction over the last couple of weeks? Can we start with footballers themselves? Raheem Sterling was on Newsnight. We've seen players at protests like Tyrone Mings. We've seen teams together taking the knee in the Bundesliga before the game. Have you been enthused, Troy, by the actions of the players?
I think the players during this whole period of time have been absolutely amazing. There was a judgment call on them very early doors on the pandemic, and they stood up and they announced players together. During conversations, obviously, to get Premier League back on, they've made their voice known. And on this particular topic, the power of the player has really borne through. You know, Marcus Rashford, Rhian Brewster, just have been so powerful in the way that they've spoken and deliberated and taken their time amongst the others that you've mentioned, Max, to deliver a message, you know, to deliver a important message the way they wanted to. Not scripted, not designed by the backroom staff, but their message, their voice. And seeing players do that, seeing players take the knee with a strong, powerful message in Germany, seeing Jadon Sancho score hat-trick, and the most important thing for him, his first career hat-trick, by the way, the most important thing to him was to recognise George Floyd. The most important thing for Germany football was to investigate the fact that he had a written message and he exposed it. Tells me everything that I need to know about maybe the distance between the players and the authorities now. Players have power, a power that I don't think they've truly appreciated in the past, or a power that has been doused in the past because it doesn't fit the narrative, doesn't fit the agenda. And I think that power is now coming through more and more and more. How they're, you know, in the messages that they're saying, when they're joining the crowds, how they're deliberating on their responses. And I'll go as far as to say how they've gone on to a variety of podcasts that are not the established podcasts. How they're lending their voices to different audiences that are not the established audiences. And yes, it's been easier because it's been locked down, but actually it's been so appreciated by so many fans that actually now I think players are closer to the fans than ever before. And for me, that is a strength and a power that needs to remain because, and I'm going to be honest, players have been used as commodities far too often in this industry. And when the industry doesn't want them, it spits them out and it throws them away and it starts to talk about them negatively. Let them use the power of their voice and their standing in the game to help drive the change that hopefully we will have.
I'm conflicted because while on one side, I loved seeing Tyrone Mings marching in Birmingham at a time when Aston Villa, you know, when the season resumes, they need him, you know, fit and fighting to battle relegation. He's put himself in a position where, you know, he could have caught the virus amongst other people, but yet he understood the importance of being there. Marcus Rashford, I can't speak highly enough about Marcus Rashford and the work that he's done and the money he's generated. And I saw the Raheem Sterling interview just this morning, actually, from last night's Newsnight. So that gives me some confidence that footballers are taking the initiative here. But I'm also annoyed that they, being the Premier League, managed to kind of come together for football together, to come together to put together an initiative that decided how much they would give and the finances during the virus. But yet they couldn't come together before now, or still haven't come together before now, to form some kind of committee as football players and black football players to decide what we're going to do about racism within our game. I would love, I've said for years, I've been pro walking off the pitch when racism happens. For about 5 years now, I've said that. Some people think it's not the right thing to do. I think it is. I would have loved more black players in particular to have backed up Raheem Sterling's Instagram post a couple of years ago off the back of the abuse that he received at Stamford Bridge. And a lot of people say it's not footballers' role to fix racism, and it's harsh, and it is harsh, but the footballers have the power. If Paul Pogba, Wilfred Zaha, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, N'Golo Kanté, some of the most high-profile black football players in the Premier League, all took a stance, the Premier League would listen and the Premier League would be forced to react. And more than that, I would like to think, I don't know Harry Kane, but if he sees Aurier walking off the pitch, I think Harry Kane would walk off the pitch as well. I don't know David Luiz, but if Aubameyang walks off, I think Luiz will walk off as well. So the players, I think, could do a lot more. Is it their job? Maybe not. But they're in a position of power, I feel, where if they grab this situation now, in the way they grabbed the situation regarding players together, I think the players could really force institutions and governing bodies to make change.
Jordan, why did you just mention the black players? Why has the onus has to be on the black players? You know, why is it that this is not a joint effort? Why is this not the white players talking as hard and as strong as their black players? You go into changing rooms and they're multicultural changing rooms.
I agree.
That you cannot tell me that they do not talk about the issues that players go through. You cannot tell me that they do not try and understand the hurt that their teammates have had. I just don't understand why the pressure has to always be. I do and I don't. I say I don't understand.
I'm with you. Sorry, I'll let Elliot come in, but I'm with you. But the reason why I put more emphasis on the black players is because they're the ones that are feeling it. They're the ones that are feeling the racism first and foremost. I would love the white players to take the initiative. England captain Harry Kane, the most iconic player in the country for England, to take the lead and say, you know what, we're walking off. But I don't expect it from white players. I do expect it from black players.
It's a really interesting question, Troy. It's one that Lilian Thuram, whose son was also protesting in the Bundesliga, has raised plenty of times. I think it kind of, to me, it's very telling that whereas you don't see white players making a stand on their own or making a statement on their own very often, what you do see is white players taking part in displays of solidarity or whatever, however they're being conceived, once that's been approved by the organization. So you saw Liverpool as a whole making that stand, making a kind of message of unity. It's about the least politically contentious message they could come up with. The same with Chelsea, and you can think about the history of Chelsea and what does it mean for Chelsea to come out and say that they're standing against racism. But you don't see white players sticking their neck out and proactively speaking on this. And that is very disappointing, I think.
Do you know what I think we might see change now? I've been to, as I mentioned, many of the protests, and it's mainly white, not only white people at the protests, but it's white people on the front lines of the protests now. They're the ones on the front lines saying, no, we're going to stand with you and we're going to take the rubber bullets in America. We're going to take the baton hitters with you because we stand with you. I hope that white footballers now see that and think, you know what, if white people in society are deciding that they're going to be on the front line of this fight as well, then how about us white players do the same thing?
They should ask Pat Nevin for advice. Pat Nevin, I think, was it in the 80s that he...
That's correct.
In a post-match interview, he refused to answer the questions until the question of the racist abuse that had gone on that afternoon had been addressed. And I think it's just really sad and dispiriting that there's such isolated examples of this kind of solidarity.
Here's a question from Craig, which is, how can clubs and fans work together to make the racist minority feel unwelcome and get them out of our stadia?
I think the work is going on at the moment. Sometimes you don't have to publicise work to see it, to know that it's in action. And obviously I'm privy to that because, you know, we have an initiative called Fans for Diversity, which is, you know, Kick It Out and the FSA, Football Support Association. And for me, I've seen dramatic change in attitudes, in acceptance, in the battle, the challenge in terms of local fan bases, in terms of accepting that your fan base has a difference and is not just all white and male. There's been challenges amongst that as well, but I think it's important to note, could the work be so much more? Yes, of course it could, but you know, along with that comes a financial implication, and we're not funded to massive amounts that we could put those finances to good use in terms of, you know, the collective force of the power of those that support the team and those that work in the team to eliminate and isolate. But we've got to continue to call idiots out. We've got to continue to challenge them. You know, if they're in our fan bases, if they are the ones singing songs, if they are the ones who are showing an aggressive nature towards people of colour or people of difference, then we've got to acknowledge and applaud the fans that can then absolutely get together and battle and challenge those. This is a perfect space at the moment to be able to do that, because no fan is going to be able to go into a football club anymore, a football stadium anymore anyway, for a good period of time. And I think social media will now become awash with hatred. Not that it isn't already, but I'm saying I think it will increase. Football starts back next week, and I'm telling you now, I'm going to stay off the platform. I'm not going to listen to the opinionated views of people that will turn into the aggressive views, that will turn into the homophobic views or racist views. I'm not here for that. I haven't got enough energy for that space. We will do what we can in terms of the conversations we are having at the moment with certain football clubs and various platforms to try and provide a solution. But at the moment, no solution has worked because no platform actually is taking the situation serious enough. So there is a bit of hope, but with hope comes a financial implication. And if football needs or wants to address the issues that it has, then it has to put its money where its mouth is, even in this period of time where I know finances are quite difficult.
Actually, on that, because we have one question about Kick It Out from someone called Patrick. I saw you reply to it, Troy. Do you feel that anything has changed in relation to Kick It Out? It just feels it's been proactive in PR, but limited action. Do you think there are a lot of football fans that don't really understand
without doubt,
Kick It Out is and where it gets its money from and how much money it has, etc.?
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, I wouldn't say we're even a proactive PR spin. I don't think our PR is great, if you want me to be totally honest. Maybe we don't have the correct expertise, but, you know, people judge us with so much lack of understanding, you know. And I'll say to you, well, we get our funding from the Premier League, the EFL, the PFA, you know, and everyone says, wow, you must be loaded. Well, no, we're not loaded. We get the minimum amount to keep us ticking over. We punch above our weight. You know, we have 17 members of staff, and absolutely most of them are furloughed at the moment. So football starts back next week. And I'm telling you now, I'm worried about the impact from us as an organisation, because we have such limited active working staff at the moment. You know, we cover the professional game right down to the grassroots game, the element of the industry that people try to ignore, but the element of the industry that absolutely is like the wild, wild west, and where the people with those bigoted views are allowed to flourish. So it's a narrative that has been there for quite a long time, including from within the industry, that, you know, we should be doing more. Remember, we're not a sanctioning body. We can't put out the level of, you know, I'd love to be able, after a racist incident, say to him, can you sack that player, please? I'd love to be able to do that. But it's not our power. The power is with the governing bodies, and it will always remain with the governing bodies we try to influence.
And we will move on to the punishments or not that are doled out for racism in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Elliot Ross, the writer, Troy Townsend from Kick It Out, Jordan Jarrett Bryant from Channel 4 News with me. Elliot and Troy, when you were on the day after the Bulgaria game, we asked if it was a watershed moment, and we wondered what punishment might be doled out to Bulgaria. They were asked to play two matches behind closed doors, one of them suspended for 2 years, and fined €75,000. Troy, I don't know how you felt when that verdict came through 2 weeks after the game.
Max, you're asking me questions that I've answered on, I don't know how many times, on a platform or in a bit. That is not good enough. That is just, look, we have to punish you somehow. Take this. Don't worry about it. You know, if you are not going to use the word term expulsion, then forget it. Bulgaria have a history. Serbia have a history. We're talking about the same nations all the time that get a partial stadium closure where they then move the fans round to the other section so they don't miss out on watching their football, or a half stadium closure or a full stadium. And then people will say, oh yeah, but they're losing out the income of the paying fan. They've racially abused a group of people. What is more important, your finance or absolutely getting to the core of the problem? So unless they use the term expulsion from competition, I'm really not interested in commenting anymore on the paltry fines. They find a cat for being, they find a club, I'm sorry, I said to find the cat, some expensive cat that was. But they find,
it's hard to get a cat to court, isn't it?
They find a club, I can't remember what club because I tried to distance it from my memory, but they find a club for having a cat in the stadium. I think it was 30,000 euros for the cat dawdling across the not the pitch, but down the touchline. They find this club for a cat. You know, put that into perspective, then with Nazi salutes and the N-word and the hostility that there was in Bulgaria, and then tell me that 70 francs, euros, whatever that sums up, is enough of a punishment.
We have reported on pretty much every incident, or hopefully every incident, since the Bulgaria game. We haven't discussed them in massive detail because we wanted to do that on this special. We've got a list here, and excuse me because it is long. Incidents that have happened since then. October 2019, Haringey Borough and Yeovil Town football clubs led off the pitch by their managers in the 64th minute following racist abuse during an FA Cup match. Manchester United eject a fan from Old Trafford during a Premier League match against Liverpool over alleged racial abuse. Video footage circulates showing a group of Aston Villa fans singing about Zimbabwean midfielder Marvellous Nakamba and one other player with references to several racial stereotypes. November, Shakhtar Donetsk midfielder Tyson sent off, subsequently banned for one match after reacting to alleged racist abuse during his side's 1-0 home win against Dynamo Kiev. Everton investigated an incident of alleged racist behaviour during their Premier League draw against Spurs. December, Spurs launched an investigation after Chelsea defender Antonio Rudiger reported being targeted with monkey chants. Their findings were inconclusive. Corriere dello Sport ran a bizarre front page headline titled Black Friday alongside pictures of Inter Milan's Romelu Lukaku and Roma's Chris Smalling. The two were due to play each other for their new clubs that day. Serie A coming under fire for using three paintings of monkeys to illustrate a campaign to stamp out racism. A video circulates appearing to show a supporter making monkey gestures at Fred during the Manchester derby. Two men arrested on Boxing Day after racist chanting was reported in the away stand at Peterborough Doncaster. January, BBC Radio Derby severed ties with pundit Craig Ramage after he said he thought the Rams, quote, young black lads needed pulling down a peg or two following their 1-1 draw against Huddersfield. In February, Port Vale's Tom Pope charged by the FA after posting a tweet linking the Rothschilds to every bank on the planet, a common anti-Semitic trope. February, Schalke fans fined for racist abuse of Hertha Berlin player during a German Cup match. Porto forward Musa Marega walking off midway through his side's win at Vitória Guimarães, saying he was subjected to racist abuse from opposition fans. The Portuguese league fined Guimarães 714 euros. It's just, Jordan, it's just so depressing to hear. And that is by no means an exhaustive list. It's sobering and it's tiring. And it sort of says that question about whether it was a watershed moment, then it wasn't.
Well, yeah, you used the word depressing there, Max, and that is the word, depressing and very, very demoralizing. And the one thing it shows, which myself, people like myself and Troy Townsend and Darren Lewis at The Mirror and Hugh Woozencroft at TalkSport and other black broadcasts and journalists have been saying, they don't care about racism. How can you be anti-racism, but yet when racism appears at your door, you present it with a 2 grand fine, a 5 grand fine? These are not things that are deterrents for people to not do it again. If I'm a football fan or if I'm a football player and I'm racist, those fines are not going to make me think twice about racially abusing a black person or an Asian person. It's not. So that says to me they don't care, which is why I believe the power has to now come from the football fans and the players. The players have to now walk off for me, and the football fans, we have to get to a point we have to get to a point, Max, where the football fans have on the table, if they're serious, we are not going to go into football stadiums until the clubs and the authorities decide that they are going to take this more seriously. Now, we love football. We don't want to do that. But what's the alternative? We're here again in 6 months' time having the same discussion again. We have to have a threat on the table whereby we hold people accountable, because until we do, this will keep happening and the paltry fines and punishments will keep being dished out.
You read them out, and I went back to the beginning when you asked me, how are you? Because as you was reading them out, I'm thinking to myself, no outcome, no outcome, no outcome, paltry fine, no outcome, still being investigated, paltry fine, no outcome. And then we get an outcome. I'm not sure if you read out the Casilla Leeds Jonathan Lecco situation. We get an outcome, and we get an outcome that has a history behind it, because Casilla was punished for using the N-word against Jonathan Lecco, and was found guilty and was given an 8-match ban. The same eight-match ban that was given to Luis Suarez back in 2011. So 9 years later, we're treating the situation as if it has not progressed. The FA even fought their own. This is where
it hasn't taken account of inflation.
No, do you get what I mean? And then the FA have battled their own panel, because the FA wanted 10 match and their own panel decided on 8. So now the FA are in conflict with their own panel because they didn't administer a sanction that they wanted. And I'm thinking to myself, can this be more of a comedy act? Can we absolutely not now this and realise that what Elliot has said, he says it so much better than me, the inflation rate for racism actually has gone up. Are we treating it in the same way that we have done for all these years? Didn't affect Luis Suarez's career, did it? Didn't affect his career. But what about the people who are on the receiving it? We don't care about the victim. Added to that, Max, and I know you only started from October. Mm. You know, the Haringey
the Lecco
stuff
thing was just before. The Lecco thing was just before.
Yeah, it came out in January. Course, the decision came out in January, February, whatever it was. I got criticised during that period of time. There's situations that happened on the first game of the season that I've still not had a resolution.
You know, why is that?
They don't care. They don't care. They're not even, they're not even trying to pretend that they're trying to fight it now.
Who do you think it is that doesn't care? Because I sort of imagine on an individual basis, people think that they care.
Thinking and doing, Max, is two different things.
Sure.
Everyone can think. You know, we can all think. And like I've said now, the time for talking has to stop, and the time for action has to be implemented. Because we've been talking till we're tired. We've been talking to the point where I'm actually not sure I want to talk anymore. But people say, come on, Troy, you've got to keep doing it. So, action. And not the action that actually you think, why did you bother? What's the point? Let's have some real strong points where actually we all know that if you do that on a football pitch, you're risking your career. You're going to get a significant ban. You're going to get a significant fine. And the club that supported you in putting together your defence, because they need you as an individual, will also receive that as well. Let's start with the bar high, not with the bar very low and actually lower because we don't complete the story of any incident. Let's start with the bar high. The bar is not high at the moment. It's not challenging enough for people to question themselves. 30,000. Yeah, here we go. We give him that. That's fine. We keep the player. He's going to influence us getting promoted. He's going to influence us winning a title. He's going to influence us winning a cup. And you mentioned the Marega situation, Max. One of the worst things I've ever seen on a football pitch, the day that he got racially abused. One of the worst things. And people say, well, I've seen worse. Well, good luck to you. One of the worst things I've ever seen on a football pitch in regards to a stand against racism, and how his teammates, the opposition, the fans, the dignitary sitting up in the posh leather seats, and everybody dehumanised that individual. For what? For 3 points. He won them the game. It's disgrace. Football is a disgrace at the moment in regards to racism.
I think the incidents you describe, and that Troy's described as well, they're a really good example of how white people, white institutions, white senior management, we're at a particular phase now, I think, in the UK where, and you've probably seen a lot of this week, where the sort of PR function and the public language and the messaging, that says one thing, and then the reality of the policy says something very different, and the reality of those institutions internally and how they're run says something very different. And I think, you know, you hear zero tolerance for racism, everyone will sign up to that, and then it's just every single one of these examples, it's like, oh yeah, we have zero tolerance, but there are mitigating circumstances. We have zero tolerance, but in this case, you have to consider that the proof was inconclusive. We have zero tolerance, but our fine structure looks like this and we're not willing to change it. And what that is institutional racism. And that's how it works. So, you know, Max, you're asking about like the particular intentions of individual people involved. Mm. It's not that those don't matter, but they're lost among the structural elements of this. And they're lost in relation to the discomfort and the high price that is currently placed on white people, white institutions actually taking this seriously and actually acting in the way that Troy and Jordan are calling for.
For me, it's about the lack of accountability. So there's an interesting parallel with football's problem of racism within football, but also with what we're seeing societally in terms of the marches. So the reason people aren't marching across the world for George Floyd or Breonna Taylor or anybody else that's died, individuals. They're marching for those people, of course. But what we're really marching for, what I'm marching for, is is justice and the fact that black men can be killed and black women with impunity. So people will always kill people. There'll always be bad people on the planet. That will always happen. My problem is that if you're going to kill somebody, there needs to be a consequence to it. There needs to be accountability for that. And for too long, white police have been unaccountable. Bringing it to football, it's the same problem. If you're going to racially abuse me as another fan, or racially abuse, you know, Troy's son or Aubameyang or Pogba, whoever, that's your decision. But we need to know as black people and as human beings, full stop, that there is a consequence to that action. If you have accountability and consequences for people who do this, believe me, the amount of people that do this, the numbers will drop. But people are racially abusing people because they know they will get away with it.
Do you have any hope that what is happening right now and the protests and the marches that will perhaps change a lot of football fans from being so tribal about their football team? So we discussed this about Newcastle United and their ownership, that they're, you know, they are, a lot of Newcastle fans just want to win. So it doesn't matter who owns their club, with reference to the Saudis coming in. And this idea of what is the point of football, right? What is the point of it, right? Is it about winning at all costs? So you know, you will defend your player who's accused of racism because he's really good. Do you have any hope that people might take a step back and actually would rather support a team that didn't have a racist player?
I'm an Arsenal fan, and I saw Arsenal post their expression of solidarity. I think they posted the black tile one day last week. And I think these sort of PR posts, they're not the worst thing in the world. They need to be backed up with action, but they also provide an interesting opportunity for accountability. And my question was just, well, it's nice that Arsenal are saying that they value black life, they value black people. Has there ever been any black person in senior management at Arsenal? Are there any black coaches? Have we ever had a black manager? And I hope those are the kinds of questions that football fans will ask of their own club. Just another point on that, I think there's a dynamic that I've noticed in terms of how these issues are discussed, and it came up again in the Raheem Sterling interview on Newsnight, where a version of a question is asked, like, is this the moment when things change? Are we finally there? And it's always a white journalist or person asking that question, like, have we finally reached the point where racism is going to end? This is how Obama's presidency was framed famously. And I think we need to stop asking that question, particularly of black people, because in some ways it just minimizes the depth and the seriousness and the structural aspects of what's underpinning all this. Things can change, things can get better, but I think looking for a kind of light switch moment and asking people, is this the time? I think that's also, we talked to as well about the experience of being tired about talking about these issues. And I don't know, I'd be interested, Jordan and Troy, is that a question you hear a lot? Like, what about this time? Is this the time when people will finally realize that racism is bad?
I've had it asked about 20 times since Thursday.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Simple as that.
But you know what's a more worrying question? I saw on a radio station, I won't name them, they had a discussion, was framed with the question, is Britain racist? And that for me is the problem. If you're starting a discussion with that question, then it's just like, it's hard to have hope. I do have some hope that this may be a significant moment. But then I see someone tweet that they're having a discussion centralized around the question, is Britain racist? I mean, really? Is that the starting point for discussion? That concerns me. So that does hurt my hope, if you like. But I do have a lot of hope that young people now and younger football fans seem to be understanding that it's wrong and actually seem to be acting and making their voices heard. I just hope that they use their money and their finances to really send a message out to corporations in the football world. If you don't change, we will spend less of our money with you.
Now, the FA brought in a similar principle to the Rooney Rule in the NFL. And as of 2018, 13% of coaches in the England setup were black and ethnic minority. They've set a target of increasing this to 20% by 2021. Is that something that should be brought in across the board in football? And if so, how do we implement it?
The rule is in place. The mandatory code for the English Football League, the Premier League, will not adopt it. So then again, it's not a beneficial rule. It's great having the objective of diversifying your elite setup, the England setup. It's not actually fit for purpose, if you ask me, but we'll go into that a little while. You know, it's great trying to diversify the England camps, the elitist camps. But what about the everyday work, the fact that we still only have six black and Asian ethnic minority managers in the league, and it will go up from 0 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 6 back down to 4 to 3. Where's the opportunities for all the coaches that are qualified? The question always get asked, well, maybe they ain't qualified, or maybe no, they are qualified. I've seen the list of all the coaches that are qualified that are not getting opportunities. Where's the list of the coaches that have actually gone for these roles, have been turned down? Where's the learnings? Where's the briefing for them to actually, you know, try and go again? The mandatory code is a code that is in place. It's the football's version of the Rooney Rule, but with everything, we have to tinker it and tailor it. So, you know, if I'm an owner of a football club, I can sack my manager tomorrow and announce you, Max, within an hour. And the Rooney Rule is not applicable to that because I've not made it an open recruitment process. And by the way, how many times has that happened in football where the board sack a manager and I've already been speaking to the previous person for the last 3 weeks to guarantee that he gets the job, and they're waiting for one more bad result to give him the job? So unless you tinker the rules, unless the rule is for everybody, why do we have the rule in the English game? It's I don't see it as fit for purpose. I don't see it as, you know, if we've got 91 clubs have to adopt the rule, and the rule has to be about a recruitment process, not whether you are deciding on a recruitment process or that you've actually know the person you're going to employ. Simple as that.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, I will ask some difficult questions for me and for this podcast. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. I want to talk about the podcast itself. it is often for middle-aged white men. It was yesterday, if Nick Ames doesn't mind me calling him middle-aged, along with Philippe and Ed Ahrens. We do have representation from black and ethnic minorities and women as well. Marvin Sordell, Musa Kwonga, Marcus Bean. Lots of women are on Flo, Faye, Susie, Nikki, Salon, Reshmin. Is it ever okay for it to be me, Barney, Barry and Jonathan Wilson?
It's okay as... I think it's not. It hasn't got to be as difficult as a lot of broadcasters and producers of podcasts think it is. You could force the agenda by saying, okay, if we're a weekly show, we're going to ensure that of the four shows we do a week, at least two of those shows, we're going to have a woman on. At least two of those four shows, we're going to have a non-white person on. So then straight away you increase the, we're going to have a young person on. Do you know what I mean? So straight away you increase the mix. Now, there's obviously got to be a level of, there's got to be a quality and a standard. You don't just get a black person for a black person's sake. Although, kind of to counter my own point, I see a lot of average white broadcasters getting repeat work. So if white
There's no need to talk about like me like that.
I didn't want to name any names, but if average white men can get consistent work, then why can't I? But the point I'm making is that I don't think it's difficult to just have a, to decide if you're serious about diversifying the voices and the faces on your shows or your podcasts, just make a commitment that one in four shows minimum, we're going to have a woman. Two in four shows, we're going to have a non-white person. I just think organically that will snowball and then you'll notice the tone and the quality, I think, of your show will be so much more varied and better. And ultimately, the winner is your, are your listeners.
So I have another question about this, which is I'm obviously, I really want diversity. I want equality of opportunity, right? But I'm also aware that I fill a seat, okay? And I've had this conversation on TalkSport as well. How do I resolve the conflict of wanting that, but at the same time wanting to keep my job, you know?
Matt, now is the time when anyone who has a platform, you know, owners of businesses, media outlets, if you're not open for the conversation now and the benefits of it, then you'll never be. You know, Jordan's right. You know, out of four shows, can you have better representation, which may open you up to a much wider audience, by the way, which then helps people engage with the pod even more beyond the two shows that you have that representation. If your fear is that your bosses are now going to look at you in a different light, then this is not about you. This is about your bosses. And that would be in any instance. If the boss is on another major platform decide that they want to let's have better representation, but you do know we're only going to tick the box because actually we don't really want to see that much diversity on our screens. It's that conversation, it's that uncomfortableness that we, I think that's what we're asking to be brought to the table. I think out of everything, and people have said to me, is this a seminal moment? Is now the time that we will see change across industries, across platforms, in institutions? I don't know. I can't provide you the answer. I'm always skeptical because I had it in 2018 and I had it in 2013 and I had it in 2011. There were seminal moments in probably every year that people say, this is it. To be let down again, to be asked to come on a news channel to talk about racism when no one gives a damn. So actually the questions need to be asked within your own environment, through appreciation and understanding. And they need to be difficult ones. It's not a, shall we? No. Okay. That's cool.
Can I broaden it out from this podcast? Because, you know, that affects, you know, people listen to it, but like on the wider sense, you know, I reek of privilege, right? I was born in central Cambridge. I went to private school. Until I was 16, I went to one of the best.
Could you not just say you was born in Cambridge? Why do you need to say central Cambridge?
I don't know. It's posher, right? It's the poshest bit, CB1, right? It's pretty posh. I'm brutally aware of all my privileges. I'm not ashamed of where I came from, right? But I think I'm nice. And I think a lot of middle-class white people are having this conversation is what should I be doing now? Not specifically on a podcast, but just in my life. What are the right things to be doing? I want to do the right thing. I'm conflicted as to, or I agonize about what that right thing is.
So I can give you three things that you can do. I'll be brief. First of all, educate yourself. I think white people need to start off by educating themselves and try to further understand why black people are where they are right now in terms of the anger, the frustration, and in America, the violence we're seeing in terms of the rioting. Have an understanding, and you can do that by reading certain books. Elliot mentioned earlier on why I'm no longer talking about white people about race. Think Like a White Man, White Fragility. There's three books already. Watch some films. Do the Right Thing, Roots, 12 Years of Slaves, When They See Us, 13th. All things that will help you understand why black people are where they are. I have an account. I have a podcast and a YouTube show where we educate and empower our own community. That will then help white people understand where we're at right now. The second thing, educate your mates in your social circles. So when you hear certain jokes and certain comments being made amongst your friends, say, no. That doesn't run no more. We don't make those jokes. That's not cool. That's not right. We don't do those jokes around here no more. Shut your mates down and educate your friends. Because once you educate yourself, you can then multiply that by 10 of 10 of your friends. And then 10 times 10 times 10, we will educate ourselves. And the third thing is, going back to yours and Troy's last point in the workplace, checking your bosses. So looking around your places where you work, be it Guardian, be it TalkSport, be it BBC, wherever people work, why is it I'm looking around the building and there's so few black people in positions of power? Is it a coincidence that most of the cleaners are black, yet most of the bosses are old white men? Is that a coincidence? Or is that because a system makes it harder for certain group of people to access the positions and opportunities where they can be in positions of power and others have an easier route? Ask your bosses what's going on. And we don't want just some hand-wringing and sympathizing. We want commitments to change. We want targets. Set a 12-month target that by this time next year, we will see more diversity in our workplace.
Just finally, chaps, a couple of questions. Rory says, and I know you mentioned some stuff before, Jordan, but I think it's probably worth repeating it. Are there any books or articles or anyone on the pod that you would recommend to read on racism in sport and or racism in general in order to educate myself further?
Yeah, well, I've dug out three books that I think are, without patronising white people, quite digestible, quite easily to understand racism. There's one called award-winning book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, Think Like a White Man, and White Fragility. They're the three books that I would recommend people who want to have an understanding of how difficult it is being a black person in the corporate world, in society, and just regular out there in the world. Those are three books I recommend. There's a few films I could recommend. 12 Years of Slaves, When They See Us is a Netflix series. 13th is really, really emotional and gives you a sense of the justice system in America and how black people are treated there. Do the Right Thing is a classic Spike Lee film that I think really gives you the better understanding of dynamics of how, again, black Americans in the late 80s and early 90s had to navigate living in a racist society. And I don't have any top of my head accounts to follow, but there are so many great Instagram, Twitter accounts that you can follow where you can really get an understanding from certain scholars and writers and thought leaders that will really articulate well the struggles of how difficult it can be being a black person in Britain and in the world.
I think it's important to include the BBC show last night, Sitting in Limbo. You know, Jordan, a lot there is about America, but what about England? What about in this country? So systematically, yeah. How has the nature of our own racism, you know, and our look at black people, you know, and how we've judged the generation before mine, you know, the generation that came over and helped with the NHS, the generation that came over and helped with public transport, the generation that actually formed a new life here and had children here. But yet they were then being judged because of whatever legal system we had and made and put on planes to go home. You know, I sometimes get lost for words because I think when I speak so much, the emotion starts to take over. But anyone that thinks it's just an American problem, watch that. It's 90 minutes. It's hard hitting. If it doesn't hit you hard, then maybe you don't want to learn anyway, you know, and it's those things that we have to recognize because things happen in this country as well. As much as what we want.
It's actually worse here. Sorry, Troy's right. A lot of those books I've mentioned do reference racism in America. But I actually think racism, despite people seeing people being shot in America, I think racism is worse in Britain. I think it's subtle. I think it's embedded. I think it's a lot more systematic in the way it's built in this country here. I've always said, if you're a racist person, I'd much rather know you're racist and you don't like me because I'm black. I'd much rather you just tell me, I don't like you because you're black. Whereas here, a lot, it seems to be more of smiling in your face, talking, joking, banter, ha, ha, ha. When they go home, that black so-and-so, these black people. So that's the reason why I think here we've got a bigger problem, especially with our current government and governance within football as well.
I think a couple of pieces from the last week that I found really interesting and enlightening were by Gary Young, who wrote for The Guardian for many years. One is in the New York Review of Books, and that kind of gets really deeply into the kind of transatlantic aspects of this and what it means for, you know, the police murder of a black man in Minnesota to filter or to cross the Atlantic, and the ways in which racism and its consumption, if you like, through media has moved between Europe and America. It's a really fascinating essay and draws a lot on his own reporting in America as well as obviously here. He also has another article this week in the New Statesman that talks about coronavirus and the ways in which coronavirus has affected black people disproportionately and other ethnic minorities also disproportionately. And I think one challenge as white people is that a lot of the things that I think we sometimes hear from people like Gary about their experience and about the black experience feel kind of counterintuitive. So I think a lot of white people, if you said to them, well, coronavirus has this kind of racialized element to it, they'd say, well, what do you mean? And I think it's good to try to kind of, as much as possible, to be aware of that and to try to counter that just by learning and listening to people who have researched this stuff and who know what they're talking about and can explain things to you that don't necessarily fit with your common sense or your sense of how things line up.
But it's also, just quickly, I think it's about people, if you want to learn and understand, we have a website, I don't know if you heard of it, called google.com. So those that really want to understand this, I mean, we can give recommendations. I can tell you, read this book, check out this podcast. But if you really, as a white person, want to understand this, you can just Google these things. It's not, they're not hidden. They're not like in some black Google that only we have access to. They're out there. Do you know what I mean? So as much as we can help with reading lists and recommendations, if you're a white person, you want to, some people don't want to understand and they want to learn, that's fine. They'll be who they are. But those that do, just Google, just read. There's so many books out there. Just look for yourself. It's not difficult.
Yeah. And I'd say on that, just four names for listeners to Google: Belly Majinga, Shukri Abdi, Mark Duggan, Sheku Bayo. And if you think that racism is an American problem, Google those names.
Can I just say as well about British history? And obviously the very nature of statues that are up all over the country has come into prominence a lot more now. There's your starting point. Start reading up on the history of a lot of these statues and the reason they are there. And let me give you a starter for 10. A lot of the culture around this that are being lauded because, you know, these are our statues. They've been there. We celebrate them. We this. A lot of those people responsible for dehumanizing black people, they're responsible for mass murders. Ultimately, they're responsible for many a black person. So I don't want to just say myself, but many a black person's last name, their slave name. So if you want to delve into history properly as well, along with what the other two guys have so expertly said, have a look at the British culture and its history. Really understand about the statue that you want your picture taken next to and what that person did during that period of time. and how we still believe that it's right to celebrate what that person did, those individuals did.
Finally, and I don't know if there is anything, but Jackie says, what is something that has given you hope this week?
I've mentioned it earlier, I think, young people. I think when the young people start uprising and the young people start taking to the streets and the young people use their platforms to not only say that enough is enough, but actually put those words into action in the form of A, wanting to, you know, buy books, read films, speak to their black friends and understand why black people are so angry and hurting. And then actually going to the streets, as I mentioned earlier, I've been to most of the marches and there's so many young people that aren't, I mean, there's some people there that are just there for a selfie and just there because it's trendy. But there's so the majority of young people are there because they understand that it's wrong. It is wrong to treat people. This is not even a black issue. This is a humanity issue. This is an issue of humanitarianism. This is about people. This is about saying we want to live in a world as young people where we're all treated equally and we all have an equal chance of succeeding. We won't all succeed. Some of us aren't good enough in certain areas, but we shouldn't be held back because of we're a woman, because we're black, we're disabled, we're gay. So what's given me hope is young people's response to this. And I think it was Obama in a speech last week said that if you look throughout history, it's always been young activists and young leaders that have led any kind of revolution. So for me, the one thing that's given me hope is that young people are taking a proactive action.
I would probably say added to that, and Jordan is spot on there, is togetherness. I think sometimes, well, the media feeds a narrative that they want you to see and want you to hear and want you to witness. And then because of the advent of camera phones and the fact that people can film their own footage, as unfortunately we've seen with George Floyd, I've also seen togetherness. I've seen empowerment of different people from different backgrounds all coming together for a common goal. That won't make the 10 o'clock news. It won't make the 9 o'clock news. A lot of those people are younger. So Jordan is right, spot on, how the younger generation have taken on this message. Now, my time's done soon. And if we cannot empower our younger generation to be our leaders, then why are we here? Why are we doing this? You know, proactively challenge, proactively, you know, appreciate each other and understand each other, because we're all different, each and every single one of us. And I think the togetherness for me, along with what Jordan has said, is the hope for the future.
Two things from me. Minneapolis is dismantling its police department, and that's happening because of the riots and the people who've taken to the street to fight for that after George Floyd was murdered. And then the statue of Colston being dumped in the river in Bristol, or the sea. Is it the Bristol Channel? Is that where it is? I don't know, so, Bristol.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I mean, I think seeing that statue fall into the sea was kind of the first time that I thought maybe there's some possibility here for Britain to transform its relationship with our history of empire and its legacies and the harmful effects that they continue to have.
Well, look, that is long, and our podcasts, we always get told to keep them under an hour, but I think it's important. And thank everybody for listening. And thank you to you three. Thank you to Jordan. Thank you, mate.
Cheers, pal. Thank you.
Elliot, thank you.
Cheers, Max.
Troy, I thought you'd left already, but you're still...
I was trying to make a getaway, but no.
So rude. You're still late. Hey, you were late, Troy. That's why we started. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming on, Troy.
Absolute pleasure as always, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.